Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I am Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilber, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects.
Great to be here today. I'm super excited about today's guest, Paul Cotter, one of the really spectacular scientists out there doing work on fermented foods. He's traveled the world and has all sorts of interesting information about different fermented foods. I brought some special guests today, though, before we get to Paul. David and Aliza, can you see what these are?
Yep.
What do they look like to you?
They're just tiny little grains.
They look like mucus.
It's not so cauliflower.
A lot of snot out of my child's nose these days.
One of the few things that I love more than mucus, which is actually kefir grains, also referred to as kefir grains. But since I'm from California, I'll probably say kefir. But these grains are like members of my family. I work with them every day. Just such an easy way to ferment milk. I transfer them from, an overnight culture. It's been sitting on the counter just to fresh milk. So I strain them. What comes through the strainer is, of course, wonderful drinkable kefir. You can do a ton of things with it. You can bake with it like buttermilk, or you can just drink it or blend it into smoothies. But the grains themselves are these, spectacular multi-species organisms. There's dozens of microbial species in there, of course, and they grow over time. So as they grow and they get maybe bigger than what I need, I can give them to other people. So there's all sorts of children of these grains that have been distributed out there to friends and people that I work with. But they have their own character. They have incredible kind of place in our inner household for creating something that is just always in our refrigerator and something delicious and healthy to drink. But I know that there's, big differences between yogurt and kefir, even though they're both fermented dairy products as well. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely speak to that. I mean, kefir is a far more complex community. These grains are, like you said, they're whole ecologies. You tend to find that in microbiology, when you have any form of like a physical structure, like a zooglial mat in the case of kombucha, or this polysaccharide matrix that's made by the microorganisms in kefir, it's like a tiny city. And it becomes a home for so many different types of organisms to live together, especially when culture comes into that and humans come into that picture. And there is this physical manifestation of the transferring of that form into, a new environment as you do between each batch. The same thing with kombucha, when you compare it to the complexity that you would have in, say, an industrially produced wine or, some other sort of fermented beverage. You just have this enormous variety of organisms living together. In a paper by Sonia Blash from the Patil Lab out of the University of Cambridge, she describes it as like a base camp lifestyle. Like, the grain community consists of bacteria like Lactobacillus, Kefirano faciens, Lactococcus lactis, Leuconostoc mensuroides, Acetobacter fabarum. The kefir grain community doesn't change, but the milk community will change too. We have Kefirano faciens again, will be the most abundant, and we have Lactococcus lactis. Leuconostoc mensuroides will increase in its abundance. And near the end of fermentation, L-kefiri and Acetobacter fabarum will begin to increase in their relative abundance too. The advantage of all this is that it's a very short fermentation time. And the ease of preparation allows you to study changes in that community composition fairly rapidly, definitely within a work week when compared to something like cheese.
It also makes a really interesting model because every kefir grain community will be slightly different, where the community might be similar at a species level, but can vary greatly at a strain level. So in kefir, you're starting with a starter. It's not a spontaneous ferment, but it is uncharacterized, at least at a strain level. And it's going to be really personalized to the grains, to your grains that you have. And, you know, this gets into the question of how do we even go about identifying microbes in fermented foods? And there's been a lot of work looking at kefir and sauerkraut and kimchi, but there's also a lot of other ferments in the world that have been relatively understudied, and we don't really know what their microbiome looks like. But the main method that has been used in microbiology for a long time is to culture the microbes to identify them. So let's say you have some kefir and you want to identify what is growing in it. What you would do is you could take some drops of the kefir, or you could take some of the grains and put them on an agar plate and see what grows. But of course, you know, there are some big problems. Culturing has its limitations that have been known for quite some time. Primarily, it's that, you know, there are very few microbes compared to all the diversity out there that grow on these agar plates, because a lot of microbes are very, very picky. And they will have different nutrient preferences, different preferences for the amount of oxygen, different temperatures. And so it takes a lot of work to figure out the right combination of all those things in order to get the microbes that you want to grow. And so when you're starting with an unknown community, something that you want to characterize, being able to figure out if you're capturing all the diversity in there can be really hard. And, you know, you even get to the problem of some microbes also hate growing alone. So when you are trying to isolate them to grow them and then sequence them independently, you're not going to be able to do that because they're just happier to always have a buddy with them when they're growing and growing these co-cultures. Rachel Dutton and Ben Wolf, who was a previous guest, have been trying to get at this by building these cheese rind communities. And they actually have this really, really cool method where they would take cheese curds, dehydrate them, and then incorporate them into the agar plates. And so that's a way to get around some of this kind of nutrient preference thing, where, you know, if you already know what the microbes are growing on naturally, you just can stick that in the plate and see what happens. And so they've been very successful in developing these models. And I've actually tried doing that with sauerkraut and kimchi, making a slurry and adding that to the plates and see what would grow. But, you know, as I mentioned, the problem is if you don't know what you're looking for, you don't know if you're actually capturing all the diversity. So what do we do with the other microbes that we might not be able to culture? That's where metagenomics comes in. Metagenomics is a sequencing technique where you perform what's called shotgun sequencing, which is an untargeted sequencing technique. You basically are able to just sequence as many bits of DNA in your sample at random. And then what you can do is once you've sequenced them, you can start assembling them. So basically putting them together like little puzzle pieces, seeing what bits overlap in the different DNA segments that you have. And you're able to build these genomes from scratch. And that's what we call MAGs, or metagenome assembled genomes. And then from there, what you can do is take your MAGs and compare them either to reference genomes or see what microbe the genome might belong to by looking at different gene markers. So you're looking specifically at different genes that you're finding in these MAGs. And then in that way, you can get a better sense of abundance and diversity of all the microbes in your sample that might not grow well on the plates that you have available or might not grow alone, but it could still play a role in fermentation. Metagenomics is really fun. I've been working in the fermented food metagenomics for a bit, and it's been really interesting to find these microbes that you might not expect in fermented foods. That's also work that Paul has focused on for most of his career, looking at microbial diversity in fermented foods, including these underrepresented ferments, and collaborating with people all around the world to help them identify what is actually in their fermented foods and to study them. And so we're so excited to talk to him today about all the great work that his lab has been doing. Today's guest is Dr. Paul Cotter. Dr. Cotter is head of food biosciences and a senior principal research officer at Chagas Food Research Center, as well as an adjunct professor at the University College Cork. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited to have you today, and there's a lot of ground that we want to cover. But before we dive in, could you give us a little bit about your background and how you got into your fermented food work?
So here in Cork, in the south of Ireland, there's a long history of research relating to dairy in particular, and by extension, fermented dairy that's long predates me. So I guess I'm standing on the shoulders of very many different giants, people like Charlie Daly, Ger Fitzgerald, more recently Colin Hill and Paul Ross. And so it was easy to follow in their footsteps to initially work on cheese and other dairy fermented foods, but obviously that snowballed over the years.
And so what are you focusing on now?
Oh, wow. Okay, so we take a variety of different approaches when it comes to fermented foods. Some is to study the microbiology of the foods themselves, and we do that in two different ways. We take particular foods that we study in very great depth, and these kind of flagship foods include milk kefir, water kefir, cheese, kombucha, I would say. And then we also take a cross-sectional approach where we try to look at as many different examples of fermented foods as possible from as many different societies and countries across the globe. So that's to study the microbiology. But then as we go along, we want to do more. So we like to look to see how the microbes correlate with the flavor of the foods. We've done some work relating to the metabolome, as well as the aforementioned volatilome. Proteomics is an interest. We're doing increasingly some metatranscriptomics. And then there's a whole other part of our research where we're looking at the overlap between the microbes in the food and those in the gut, and how we can impact health through either animal models or ultimately preferentially in humans in a broad variety of different ways.
You mentioned your work with fermented foods from around the world, and we'd really love to hear more about how you've been working to expand this fermented food landscape.
Yeah, so again, we've done that in the same two ways. So we've taken some foods, primarily milk and water kefir, where we've sourced examples of those from as many different places as possible and reached out to people through social media campaigns and otherwise. The logic there being to see if the versions that we have in Ireland or that we've studied previously from Western populations are similar to those from other parts of the world. And where there are differences, what might contribute to those differences? And I can maybe get back into that in more depth later on in the discussion. And then another approach has been coming back to the aforementioned Global Fermented Food Microbiome Initiative, has been to either reach out to researchers in different countries or to host researchers. And we've done that in many instances for people coming from Africa or South America, whereby they've brought their foods with them and they've wanted to study those in greater depth. So for the African foods, that's included, I've made a note here, so some of the things include nunu, gari, which is a fermented tuber, ogi, which is a fermented cereal, ogiri, a fermented legume, a variety of different cheeses from South America. But ultimately, we're interested in all sorts of, as many different weird and wonderful foods as we can get our hands on.
And I have a question, Paul. Where do you see, it feels like in your work that you're trying to kind of map the world. Like you have, you know, in the spirit of Haeckel almost, you're kind of, you know, cataloging and documenting and arranging all these amazing kind of cultural, you know, cropping ups, putting it all into a map. I'm fascinated, maybe as much as Haeckel or as much as Darwin or as much as Linnaeus, about these kind of convergent evolutionary events and cultural ones at that. You were mentioning some of these African events, some of which I've heard of but don't know very well. One of my most fascinating kind of encounters is Dawa Dawa from West Africa. That is a very analogous and kind of independently discovered ferment, an alkaline ferment that's very similar to natto in Japan. Do you see a lot of these kind of overlaps in your work, where you see these cultural convergences on completely different continents in isolated kind of traditional societies?
Yes, and I can maybe refer to a study that was performed by a former PhD student of mine, John Leach, and John made the first effort at cataloging some of the foods that we studied from across different jurisdictions. And what he found is when he did a beta diversity plot, so where you kind of do this almost abstract art type image where you have a dot representing each food, and the dot on the graph, if the two dots are similar, they'll be closely located. If they're far apart, they're dissimilar. And he found a lot of clustering, and that clustering very much reflected the substrate that was being fermented. So a lot of the fermented dairy microbiomes coalesced, those from that we regarded as being kind of sugar-based fermented beverages. So kombucha and water kefir showed similarities. And then you kind of had the brine-based foods, which logically included sauerkraut and kimchi. And then you had some others that were a little bit different. So we had some soy-based fermented foods. We didn't have very many of those, so they kind of were a small cluster to the side. And then we had some kind of hybrids or Frankenstein foods where somebody had thought to put a milk kefir grain into a coconut milk, and it fell a little bit between two stools. But I guess that makes sense, because you're selecting the environment and the pH and the nutrients and whatnot that is going to enrich for the growth of particular microbes. There will be obviously subtleties. There might be similar genera but different species, or similar species but different strains. But there is quite a bit of, as you say, a kind of a convergence towards similar microbes, similar communities as a consequence of what it is that you're doing to what the raw materials are and what you're doing to them.
Very cool. And maybe a follow-up to that. It sounds like fascinating research, and I'd love to see that plot. It really seems like you're taking an active role in kind of going to these places that maybe aren't so weird as an acronym. You know, Western, educated, white, you know, all these things. Being cognizant of that, where in the world do you feel that maybe academia is underserving kind of traditional fermentation knowledge? And are you taking active steps to kind of dig deeper into those areas?
So I think that we've still only really just touched the tip of the iceberg when it comes to African fermented foods. There's challenges in terms of, we like to work with local academics. It means that we're interacting with them with the idea being that we can generate the data and share it with them for practical applications locally, because we're always conscious of not breaching Nagoya protocols or to be perceived that we're trying to pillage their foods and their strains and run off with them and make a commercial profit out of them. So, but that also means that we need to have genuine links and relationships. And in some locations, that's challenging. In some locations, there are fascinating fermented foods, but there are no academics or no universities located nearby. So there's always that balance between wanting to get more, but also doing things in the right way and not. And unfortunately, even in previous instances where in some countries, when we reach out to people, people have offered services, but then things get complicated and they ask for financial compensation that's over and above what would be standard. So it gets a little bit murky, which is why we like to work with academics locally so that we can help them and to help them to produce foods and to improve local foods in a manner that they have the interesting microbes, but to ensure that the right microbes are enriched or they can make a more consistent product, or that any of the challenges that they may face as a consequence of off flavors or other consequences, that they can be addressed through the research that we're doing.
Very cool. Very cool. I definitely know this a lot in my work. You know, I spend half my week with Christian Hansen, who are probably the biggest in bacteria when it comes to dairy. I'm sure you're very familiar with them. Nagoya definitely comes up a lot, you know, respecting, you know, biological origin, avoiding biopiracy, things like that. What kind of role does the university play? Because I understand through my work that it's always in Christian Hansen's interest to reach out and kind of acquire new blood, as it's called, even though new plasma or new cytoplasm, you could say. And we often kind of reach out to far-flung universities, whether that's in Indonesia or Vietnam or in Latin America, and ask to kind of, you know, see what's in their culture collections to be able to commercialize them and then have all the licensing go through. And if it becomes a product, are you kind of in that step, or is the university actually taking more of an active role to turn some of these microbes into business opportunities locally or internationally?
So I guess that's where we would like to go. It's still probably at early stages yet in that, we're still probably at the stamp collecting phase, I would describe it as, where a lot of the foods that we're studying have never even been the focus of an agar-based analysis before. So there's very little, if nothing, known about them previously. So it's a case of trying to see what's in there, trying to help to direct where there is culture-based approaches to identify what are the dominant strains or the dominant species, at least in those foods, so that if there is to be corresponding effort to generate new starter strains and new adjuncts, that the correct strains are selected, that those that are most dominant in the artisanal food would also be those that are applied for industrial approaches. And it's kind of to go back to first principles, but I would like to think that the first principles can be, we can move along from there quite rapidly, and that quite often when a fermented food is industrialized, it is done in such a way that it almost oversimplifies the food, where there is one or two strains put in and the process is designed with a view to just extending shelf life or to make a safe product, which obviously is important, but that often comes at the expense of flavor, or perhaps removing some strains that might be contributing to health benefits as well. So I think there's a sweet spot there where you can, and this is not just relating to African or far-flung relative to Ireland fermented foods, but indeed fermented foods more generally, that there's a sweet spot whereby you have the simplicity of large-scale industrial production, where companies want a simple product, very little can go wrong, and that's conducive to using one or two strains, to an artisanal scenario where you may have 20 or 30 strains or more present, to maybe somewhere in between where you have the best of both worlds, you have maybe 9 or 10 strains that are put together in a way that more closely reflects the artisanal product, but can be done in a way that also makes it more feasible to scale up and to control the quality or make the quality of the product more consistent.
Yeah, I've been really interested in that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that in your own work, this discrepancy between the commercial product and what you're studying in lab. I know you've worked a lot with milk kefir, and when you study it, you're using milk kefir grains in a lab, but it's not uncommon for people who are purchasing kefir to get something made with a starter that's not from kefir grains, but microbes that have been isolated from kefir grains. So how do you think about the difference between your work in a lab, the kind of traditional product, and the widely available commercial products, especially when it comes to thinking about this health aspect?
Yeah, great question. So I don't have an objection to the production of the foods using starter strains. What I do have an objection to is using the incorrect starter strains. So there are kefir products out there that are made through strains that you would use for making yogurt. And so in effect, what the customer is drinking, despite thinking they're buying kefir, they're drinking a dilute yogurt. And so that's a big frustration, but also a big challenge for consumers, because quite often it's difficult enough for a microbiologist when reading the label or looking at a website to discern what strains or what species are in there, never mind somebody from the general public that doesn't have that training. But another way of answering the question relates to where we have done some work in this space, and in particular some really nice work from Ben Bourie. So Ben was a joint PhD student who was supervised by me here in Teagasc in Ireland and Ben Willing in University of Edmonton in Canada. He spent the first half of his PhD here and then went back to Canada to continue the research. And what he did was to, among the many things that he did, was to screen a number of different kefir grains. So the material that contains the bacteria and yeast that you add to milk to carry out the fermentation. He screened a number of these grains by putting them into whole fat milk to see how capable they were of removing the fat or the cholesterol from that milk. And not every kefir grain could successfully do that, which is comes back to a whole personalized nutrition thing that I could speak at length about. But regardless, ultimately, from those artisanal grains, he took those forward into a mouse study. So these were mice that were fed a high-fat diet with a view to them intentionally gaining weight and them having higher levels of cholesterol. So one group of mice were fed this high-fat diet alone. Another group of mice were fed the high-fat diet and a commercial kefir that's not really kefir product. And then a number of other artisanal products that were made with genuine kefir grains in the traditional way. And of all of those, only two of the artisanal products brought about a successful reduction in weight gain. We also saw a reduction in cholesterol levels. And in one instance, for one product, a reduction in liver triglycerides, which is a very difficult biomarker to try to shift. So armed with that knowledge, Ben then recreated a community, a so-called pitched or synthetic starter community, where he picked five bacteria and four yeast and put them back together and recapitulated the beneficial effects of the original grain to show that starter strains can be as good if you use them or put them together in a logical manner. And some of those findings now have been translated into a human study that was done by the guys in Canada. So I think that's a really nice example of how to do things properly.
You know, Paul, you're touching on this idea of precision foods or personalized foods. And you mentioned earlier that you're doing metabolomics associated with a lot of these products. And I know just from the literature and some of the work that Elise is doing in the lab at Stanford, we're, you know, seeing that there are quite marked differences in the metabolites produced by foods that are, you know, claimed to be the same and are sitting right next to each other on the shelf in the grocery store. You know, compounds like phenylactic acid, abundant in some fermented dairy, not abundant in others. And this has a lot to do with the strains that are being used, not even the species, but the strains that are being used for the fermentation. And so I'm wondering, as you see this kind of roll forward and, you know, commercialization, and I want to come back to the kind of the westernization, both of the microbiome and of fermented foods as well. But as you see this kind of play forward into a better fundamental molecular understanding of what's happening in fermented foods, do you see them being marketed in ways where things like postbiotics and specific compounds are on the label with specific claims? Do you see these translating into a clinic where, for instance, a kid with allergies might get a prescription for a sauerkraut brine as opposed to, some sort of immune suppressant? I'm just curious how you see the metabolomics and personalized aspect tying in.
So from a scientific point of view, I think all of that is the way to go. So the example I gave of the kefir, so that was one example where we could reduce cholesterol. So I typically use the analogy or the example of where I make a kefir product in my kitchen, which has the right strains to reduce cholesterol. My neighbor might have another kefir that, on the basis of our studies with John Cryan in UCC, we have found that they're good for addressing anxiety. But maybe I could do with that person's kefir because I have to deal with 200 emails a day and he has high cholesterol. But how do you know? You have to tease apart the fermented food. So yes, I think that's where the science is going. I think the challenge will be the regulatory piece, especially in Europe, where it's quite challenging. Claims associated with probiotics have always been challenging in terms of the European Food Safety Authority. So to try to replicate that for different fermented foods is going to be interesting. I think it's an initiative or an approach that needs to be taken, but it will take some time. And as of now, for EFSA, there is a health claim relating to yogurt and addressing lactose intolerance, but that's the sole example. I think it's always easier where you have a scenario where the food is being used also to try to prevent the onset of an illness rather than to treat an illness, because you're getting into the medicinal food territory and different regulations there. So I think that's a whole podcast in its own right. But ultimately, it does come back to working with dietitians and different regulators in different jurisdictions in order to move the dial forward.
And we think a lot about the industrialization and its impact on the gut microbiome and how massively our gut microbiome has changed as we've become more industrialized as a society. You know, it strikes me that the same thing's happening to fermented foods, just because, you know, you walk into the store here, and with the U.S. being a harbinger of things that are going to happen probably in other places in the world, you see these things that are masquerading as fermented foods. Either they were fermented and then heat killed, and then other microbes, you know, spore formers added back so that they can claim live microbes, or, you know, things that are just brined in vinegar and then, you know, kept in the refrigerated section so that they appear to have, you know, the look of something that's fermented. You know, fermented food originally, it was a way to store, you know, keep preserve food and keep it for a longer period of time. As kind of refrigeration has become more abundant, or preservatives, I think you still have the echo of these kind of culinary traditions in a lot of these places. But over time, I think that these traditions are or will be lost probably. And I'm wondering, as you go around the globe and catalog foods, how much are you running into this? How much do you see urgency? I know people for the gut microbiome are creating things like the microbiome vault, where, you know, microbial samples from non-industrialized populations are being stored as kind of a safety net should we need these microbes down the road. I'm wondering if you're thinking about the samples you collect in kind of that respect, that this is maybe a critical moment in archiving some of these things.
Yeah, there's an awful lot in that, Justin. In general, I agree with everything you say there, but I still have some hope. I think, there was a lot of negatives associated with the COVID pandemic, but I think it resulted in lots of people having time on their hands at home and a new generation of fermented food enthusiasts springing up. Everybody seemed to be making sourdough and kombucha and whatnot, that hopefully those are habits that people retained. I think also, I guess there's influences from different countries, and maybe some of the other influences might help push in the opposite direction, in that I know in Eastern Europe and in Russia, there is large-scale production of kefir, but it's made in a way that's where it involves the use of grains, and it's scaled up in a way where the grains are used to ferment a small amount of milk, a mother culture, so to speak, and then that milk is then taken forward to the large-scale production. And so I think there will be a bit of a battle of hearts, for hearts in that regard. And what we can do as scientists is to try to educate people about the benefits of having a diversity of different microbes, an understanding of what they do, rather than just simply putting in the most convenient strain, or, as you said, even more what I regard as malpractice, where you're just doing something to the food to make it perceived or look like it may have been fermented, even though it never has been. So some of the efforts that I've been involved to try to address some of those things. So we had a large pan-European project called MASTER that's just ended, where we tried to catalogue the fermented food microbiome for very many different foods, and establish what were, together with Nicolo Sagata and Danilo Arcolini and a number of others, to create what we're calling a curated food metagenomic database. So in there, we've dramatically expanded the number of MAGs from fermented food microbiome. So for those not familiar with MAGs, they're essentially genomes that are created bioinformatically on a computer, where we can look at what species and strains are present in a food without ever having to grow them on an agar plate. So we use computer-based tools to put those genomes back together. And quite often, it really allows you to identify new microbes that nobody has ever grown in the lab. And we're finding a tremendous breadth of new, not only new species, but new genera from those foods. And so in a newer European project that's about a 1 year old now called Domino, some of those foods are being studied in greater depth, and there's a bit more of a focus on actually growing some of those strains, using them to make foods, carrying out actually genomic sequencing of those isolates on a plate and using long read sequencing and getting full assembly. So we can better characterize those foods and actually start to apply them in real world scenarios.
This issue about actually being able to see what's growing in our fermented foods, the culturable versus the unculturable, I'm kind of fascinated by that. So I'm kind of understanding that the problem is that if you were to take a sample of some traditionally fermented food or something that was artisanally done in someone's home or at a small market, bring it into the lab and then try to examine what's growing in it, by transferring some of the brine or pulverizing some of the actual vegetable matter and growing it on a petri dish, only what would be able to show up on the petri dish is what would be assumed to be in the food in the old model.
Yes, but I suppose, so increasingly DNA sequencing, and Justin and Lisa would know an awful lot about this from their own investigations. So DNA sequencing has really transformed microbiology in terms of looking at in the gut, where we know that there's a lot of bugs there that are quite difficult to grow on agar plates. That's not to say that as we learn more about them, we may not develop the ability to grow them on an agar plate. For fermented foods, there probably are some of them there that are more challenging than others. But I think when you think about growing things in a laboratory, you also have to think that there is no one agar plate that grows all microorganisms. And so really, you should use 20 or 50 or 100 different types of agar to grow as many different microbes as possible. So typically what happens is that people find what they go looking for. They use a particular agar to grow Lactococcus lactis. And then somebody shouldn't be surprised when they only find Lactococcus lactis. But there's a broad variety of other acetic acid bacteria and bifidobacterium and yeast and whatnot that are a little bit different, have unusual nutrient requirements. And unless somebody knows that in advance or has some genomic or metagenomic, preferably metagenomic data to give them some new insight, they won't know how to tweak their culture media in order to grow it. And so that's why even for these other scenarios where at least theoretically you should be able to grow a greater percentage of the microbes, because they're not in the gut, they don't need bile, they don't have these weird nutritional requirements, they still have been challenging to grow just because we haven't known everything about them in advance.
Kind of reminds me of the old adage of the drunkard that loses his keys, you know, in the last mile before his door, and then his wife comes out to look at to find him searching under the street lamp for them. And he's like, well, why would you think they're there? And he's like, well, it's the place where I can actually see. That kind of old proverb. Paul, you're talking at length about this connection between the gut and the foods. And you mentioned just briefly in your comparison with your proverbial neighbor about a kefir grain that helps with anxiety. This feels like a fascinating area of research. I mean, the name of the speaker series is Fermentation and Health, and we've touched on it throughout the podcast, more or less broadly, but it feels like some of the work that you're doing is you know, very trained on understanding this link, specifically the gut-brain axis. Can you talk more about what you've discovered about kefir and anxiety, any collaborations you have going on there to dig into these effects?
Yeah, happy to, David. So that was kind of a meeting of minds. So within our large microbiome center here in Cork, APC Microbiome Ireland, we're fortunate in that we have a large critical mass of people that work in all sorts of different fields, but all fields that are related in some way or another through the microbiome. And so as a consequence of all of that, we have the potential to establish very, very interesting collaborations very easily. So at our APC meetings, I meet every week with lots of great researchers in the field who work in all sorts of different relevant aspects. And one of them is John Cryan. And John and previously Ted Dynan were key opinion leaders in the gut-brain microbiome axis. So it was only logical that at some point we'd get our act together and actually do some research. So what we did is, as it may not be a surprise, we chose milk kefir as our model food again and used some of the models that John, animal models that John uses in his lab to investigate the impact. So we had a kind of a standard mouse model, and we also did a second study with a mouse model that behaves somewhat like a human equivalent with autism spectrum disorder. So we, in the first instance, with the wild-type mice, so to speak, we had some milk, and we also compared that with two different kefirs produced with kefir grains. And in that instance, we saw changes to the microbiota, not necessarily changes in the gut microbiota to reflect the fermented food microbes, but almost as if on their way through, the fermented food microbes changed the composition in a different way. So other things that might have been there at low levels became more abundant, and so on. And then depending on which fermented food or which kefir we gave the animals, there was a difference sometimes in their behavior, different types of behavioral tests, or differences in their immune response, either through T regulatory cells, through PBMCs and different things. So again, almost coming back to the personalized nutrition space, different responses for different kefirs. And similarly, when we did the studies with the autism spectrum disorder mice, we saw a decrease in repetitive activities, repetitive behaviors. We also saw some other changes in other immune markers, and the T regulatory response was also impacted as well. So there was some things that were kefir specific, other more general trends. We saw a general increase in GABA, and GABA is a neurotransmitter, so there's a potential for that to interact and cause some of the behavioral changes we're seeing. So what we're doing now is to continue some of that research through a joint PhD student, Ramya. And so what Ramya has been doing is to look through our various different fermented food microbiome data to look at different modules that are encoded therein that could that impact on, or that are related to, pathways relating to neurotransmitter production. So seeing which foods are enriched in those, and then carrying out the corresponding wet lab work with ex vivo gut models, and in the next little while some animal models, to see if the foods that we predict will be best in having an impact in that regard will indeed be those that have the best impact. Ultimately, all with a view to picking a smaller set of foods that can ultimately proceed onto doing the human studies to see if we can translate that into a real world application.
Very cool. And so it sounds like this is very much like still ongoing research, and you're seeing the correlations, but there's no kind of speculation as to the mode of action yet, or?
Yeah, so I guess some of the, it probably isn't too surprising for people who are active in that space to know that things like GABA production, pathways associated with tryptophan metabolism, and so on, are the things that we're looking at. But ultimately, yes, we do need to tease apart what the mode of action is in each instance. And that's always a complication with a fermented food, in that the health benefits, as you will know, that can be brought about through consumption of a fermented food can be as a consequence of an activity that's carried out in the food, some sort of bioconversion to making something more bioactive, a metabolite that's produced by the microorganism, the live microorganism, a component that's associated with the microorganism, but not necessarily a live microorganism. So some cell wall component that might still be active either even after a heat treatment. So teasing all of that apart is a little bit complicated, but it keeps us busy.
Yeah, I've always been really interested and fascinated by the gut-brain axis, and actually had worked in gut-brain axis research before starting here at Stanford. And actually the work that Elaine Siaud put out on the autistic mouse model and the gut-brain axis was what really got me interested in the gut microbiome. And I just thought it was so amazing. And so the work you've been doing has been so cool with John Cryan. But I'm also been interested in, you know, are you as you're doing this work, are you identifying trends in the impact on the gut-brain axis? And by that, I mean, you know, is it something that you're noticing based on substrate potentially? So when you look, you focused on kefir, but is it something that you might predict is broad against a number of dairy ferments? Is it something that's most likely a shared microbe across a number of ferments? For example, L-pentarum might be shared across various lactic acid ferments. Or could it be more of a strain-specific thing where, you know, you could, as long as you have this right strain producing a certain metabolite, then it doesn't matter what fermented food it ends up being?
I think it varies. So, unfortunately, I can't give you a straight answer, but I think some attributes will be more generic. So even coming back to the yogurt and lactose intolerance, I think the beta-galactosidase and that capability of so many different lactic acid bacteria to simply convert lactose to lactic acid and therefore remove the lactose from the fermented milk is a broad trait that's shared across all dairy fermented foods. But then coming back to the kefir example, there are individual scenarios where you have very similar species present, but that because of some genome island or some attribute that one has that the other doesn't have, almost kind of analogous to the probiotic industry where strain differences are all important, then that those are the main drivers of the mechanism of action. So it's both extremes and everything in between. So it really is a case-by-case scenario.
Paul, I was wondering, you know, we're talking a lot about fermentation here with fermented foods, but, you know, fermentation is a word we use a lot when we're thinking about the gut. And quite often, you know, fermentation of complex carbohydrates, what we commonly refer to as fiber, passing through the gut and the production of short-chain fatty acids. And thinking about that as kind of one of these, you know, key and perhaps keystone functions of the gut microbiome in humans. I'm wondering if you could, you know, from all the work you've done thinking about this metabolism, for us, just kind of sketch out similarities and differences of the fermentation that occurs in foods, with the idea that, of course, even in foods, there's a vast array of different metabolic processes. But yeah, I'm just curious to hear your kind of comparison.
Yeah, it's something that challenged us. When I say us, so ISAP, the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, hopefully I've got that right. So they pulled a few of us together a couple of years back to as kind of a consensus group to discuss fermented foods and to distinguish them from probiotics and talk about some of the challenges in the field, but also to come up with a definition of what a fermented food is. And so our initial thoughts moved towards addressing it in such a way that it was broad and would cover the sort of fermentation you're talking about. And that took us towards kind of what's common amongst all of those scenarios from a kind of a pure chemistry, biochemistry point of view. And even before chatting today, to remind myself, I had to look up, and Wikipedia will tell you that fermentation is a scenario where the primary means of producing ATP by the degradation of organic nutrients anaerobically. So that's a bit of a mouthful. And it's very broad, and how that was too broad to apply to fermented foods, and we simplified it quite substantially, where we said that fermented foods were those that were made through the desired microbial growth and enzymatic conversion of food components. And so in that regard, the word desired is particularly key, because some biochemical reactions that are carried out that could be in other circumstances be regarded as spoilage and do in essence evolve a kind of a fermentation like reaction. But for a food, if it tastes terrible and it has a microbe in there that makes you sick, then it's not what you want to have in your definition of a fermented food. So there's an overlap in terms of biochemistry, but when it comes to the fermented food space, I think the desired component is particularly key. And in that way, you can break down the individual foods then into all sorts of different categories, whether it involves a drop in the pH or an increase in pH in the case of natto, or break them down into different categories on the basis of the substrates that are fermented. And that was the basis of an approach taken by Michael Gansley in Alberta, where he has a very nice periodic table of fermented foods where he has them assigned based on the different names and substrates. And as a consequence of different types of chemical reactions that occur in each of those. So it's complicated, but we can at least have some broad definitions that capture things.
That's great. And you mentioned there the continuum between food spoilage and desirable fermentation. And, you know, obviously there's the case of somebody getting sick, and this is a pretty clear delineation, but on the other hand, there's the taste aspect. And I know that there can be huge cultural differences in terms of what people find appealing or unappealing. And I'm wondering, in your travels and tasting different fermented foods from different parts of the world, are there things that you would consider spoiled by taste that is the desirable outcome in other places?
Yeah, I'm running the risk of offending somebody now, but I'll give an example of fermented fish, which is very popular in Norway and other Scandinavian countries. So I haven't tasted very much fermented fish, but the few examples I've tasted, I would put it this way, it's a bit of an acquired taste. And maybe that's the most diplomatic way of putting it. But then again, there's probably other foods that that I consume frequently that other people don't like. In fact, I've talked a lot about milk kefir, but you can carry out a fermentation for different times. And so a 24-hour fermentation will result in a very mild flavor, which isn't very far removed from milk that a lot of people will be happy to drink. If you ferment it for 48 or 72 hours, it becomes, the flavor is much stronger, and not so many people will like it or may need to get used to it. Similarly, a mild cheese, a short fermentation time, is lots of people can tolerate. But I know my own kids, if we go into the section of the supermarket where there are lots of long ripened cheeses, they'll quickly disappear out the other side and they don't like it so much. So it depends on, I guess, your own background and what you're used to and what you've been brought up consuming for years and then.
And speaking of that, just if you're willing to share with us, what does your refrigerator look like in terms of fermented foods? What are your go-tos?
Yeah, so my go-to for lunch each day involves overnight oats, to which I add some yogurt and some orange juice to kind of help the microbes along, give them a bit of a boost with some dried fruit in there. So that's my go-to every day. But then, in addition to that, we would have kefir, kombucha, lots of different types of yogurts, sourdough. I don't make it, but purchase it most frequently. But I'm not the best example from our group. There are some people here who are fantastic enthusiasts that really put me to shame, who have all sorts of different blends of water kefir on the go and bring them to lab meetings and lab events that, they completely outshine me.
You know, you've done a lot of work in the fermented food space in terms of the basic science, but also the methodology. I mean, you've done a great amount of work kind of publishing protocols and getting people thinking about kind of unifying techniques. I think it's been a great service to the community. I'm wondering, going forward, in terms of we have a young researcher listening to the podcast out there, what direction would you counsel them to go in if they're interested in fermented foods? Where's the big opportunity, the big gap, the big frontier to expand into? And how much work remains to kind of get good methodologies that the field can kind of be marching together on this?
I think we're only really ramping up. There's huge amount of room for new people to get involved in this space, because there just isn't enough people to do everything. There are so many different foods that have not been studied in any great depth at all. The thing I love about fermented foods is that it's they're perfect for an academic in terms of trying to get funding, because you can take off one hat and put on another hat depending on what funding agency you're applying to. So you can be a food scientist one day, you can be a microbial ecologist the next one. You can look to see how the different microbes are interacting with one another, antagonism, synergies, and so on and so forth, to get really down into the fundamental science, looking at the metatranscriptome, various different interactions, how different metabolites are guiding the evolution. We did a really interesting citizen science project last year, or a couple of years ago, actually, but it's only kind of come to fruition now when we've submitted some papers. Others are in preparation. But what we did is we took lots of kefir grains and we gave them to second level students, and we asked them to treat them almost like Tamagotchis, for those of you that are old enough to remember them, where they had to keep their grains alive, but they could do different things to them. They could use different types of milk for the milk kefir, different types of fruit for the water kefir. Some of them looked after them really well, subcultured them every day. Others forgot about them and then tried to resurrect them. And we got samples back from each of those individuals every month for 6 months. And so we could see how the communities evolved over time. So that really gets into the microbial ecology. But then you can do very applied research where you're trying to prepare a new fermented food that either has a nice flavor or that addresses a particular health issue. Or just be a discoverer of new species and strains, and kind of find new unusual bifidobacteria and how they relate to other bifs, and find out what's specific about them. So it really gives you a broad landscape to address your scientific curiosity, which for me as a science nerd is fantastic.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that it is just such a rich spot for anybody who's curious. I think the really cool part, from getting back to kind of the health perspective that we focus on a bit with this podcast, is how fermented foods can be implemented in human studies so readily because it's food. I mean, we know there's a ton of interesting bioactive compounds, but we also know the safety profile is really excellent for fermented foods. And granted, any human study needs to be, you know, you have to proceed with caution and go through a lot of, you know, steps to make sure that everything you're doing is safe and ethical. But the bar is really a lot lower than, for instance, moving forward with other compounds that you might want to test for their impact on human health. So I really love that aspect of studying fermented foods. I'm curious, kind of the next big thing for your group. I mean, you mentioned the brain-gut axis work, the global mapping. Are there other frontiers that you're launching into that you're super excited about?
I think the recent developments that we've kind of gotten involved with, not on a massive scale, but enough to encourage us to keep going, relates to the metaproteomic and metatranscriptomic approaches to give us an even greater insight as to what the microbes are doing in food. I think the aforementioned curated food metagenomic database that came out of Master, we're putting the finishing touches to that publication. I think will be important because it's nice to have all of those for our own curiosity, but also because that will be a repository that's available, that will be made public and available to everybody. And so hopefully that will help to push the field forward as well. And the follow-on project that I mentioned briefly, Domino, would be quite intriguing in that in there we have some, we're have plans to carry out some fermented food studies with milk kefir, but rather than over a period of weeks, for that project we have a 6-month intervention study plan. So that's going to be challenging, interesting, but challenging across 3 different countries. And from that, other aspects of the project are looking at other more plant-based fermented foods. And from those, a subset will be selected for other human studies later on in the project. So, but yes, as you said there, Justin, I think there's a great opportunity, but also a requirement to do more and better human studies to really pin down what the health benefits are. In order to progress the field and to really harness the full potential of these foods in a way that as many people in society can benefit from as possible.
That's great. And before we wrap up, I just kind of want to ask about the significance of a particular bug that's come up again and again in our talk tonight, but kefir seems so central to your work, even though you investigate all these other types of ferments and styles. It really does feel like it's a model ecosystem, because I know it's not an organism. But, you know, there was E. coli, there was yeast, and maybe it speaks to this kind of, you know, archaic view of microbiology that isolation is a way to kind of understand something. But in kefir, you have a community. Is there a reason why, beyond also just Ireland being in Northern Europe, like Denmark, where milk flows very freely, is there a reason why kefir has become so central to your work?
Yeah, it was indirect, funnily enough. So earlier on in my career, especially as a postdoc, my main focus was on bacteriocins. So bacteriocins are antimicrobial peptides, or could be regarded as comparators to antibiotics, but without the bad press that antibiotics get, in that bacteriocins in the past have been used to add to foods to preserve them. But typically, bacteriocins are, instead of the weapons of mass destruction that a lot of antibiotics are, they're more kind of like the laser-guided missiles, so they can take out the bad guys without wiping out everything else. For foods, but also potentially with applications in the gut as well. And we found that kefir was a particularly good resource, a good source, I should say, of different microorganisms that were bacteriocin producers. And so we studied lots of those as individual microbes. We studied the antimicrobials they produced and so on and so forth. But then when I first came to Chagosk, I was charged with setting up a new DNA sequencing facility and applying it to study all sorts of different microbiomes. And that's where we started to, just out of curiosity, look at a broad variety of different fermented foods, and logically included kefir there. The rest is history. It just took off from there.
Very cool. Funny how research falls together and kind of colors your whole life.
Yeah, the planets align.
Yeah.
Tell us, if listeners want more information, where they can read some of your work and find out more about you.
Yeah, so I won't say converted, but encouraged to begin to use social media more a few years ago by our organization. So you can find me on X, or formerly Twitter, under @PaulDCotter. And LinkedIn is probably the other platform that I use most extensively. So you can hit me up there or send me a DM, and I'm happy to share information. And other than that, most of our publications, it's a requirement now indeed for most EU funding that the publications are available to the public, which is a great initiative. So all of our publications are available. You can look on Google Scholar or PubMed. But if you have any difficulty, send me an email at paul.cotter@chagas.ie, and I'm happy to help people out and send on PDFs if that would be useful.
Fantastic. And I do know from your Twitter account, not only do I see a lot of fermented food tweets, but I also see your running times from races that you've run. You're quite a fast runner, I've noted. So anyway, happy running. We appreciate so much you joining us today to take some time and explain your research and talk about fermented foods.
It's been a pleasure, Paul. Thanks.
Super. Thanks for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks so much for joining us for our conversation with Paul Cotter. For more information, visit us at go2.stanford.edu/fermentation-series, or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine and sign up for a newsletter. For more conversations like this one, please subscribe on Spotify. If you have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you, so email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support.